This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, September 20th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's show, we'll hear from an oral historian of comic book conventions, author of the new book, See You at San Diego. This Week in Water, we'll examine the use of fish bones and shells as fingerprints to stop illegal and unsustainable fishing. Our partners at Aspen Public Radio take us along for a hot air balloon ride with an audio postcard from this weekend's Snowmass Balloon Festival. And we'll go to our comment line to hear what's on the minds of listeners. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines, and then it's How on Earth. Coming up on The Science Show, you'll learn about beavers and how the furry rodent engineers could play a larger role in mitigating some of the worst effects of drought. Climate change, habitat destruction, wildfires, and more. At 9 a.m. comes another archival recording of a lecture by the late British philosopher Alan Watts. Then at 9:30, Terry Reardon will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first it's time for local and regional headlines with KGNU's Luis Licon.
The Denver Field Office of Federal Bureau of Investigations is looking into a series of false threats known as swatting, targeting schools across Colorado. Law enforcement yesterday confirmed at least three separate cases in Denver, Colorado Springs, and Alamosa of swatting. Swatting is when a person calls in a false report to police claiming an emergency situation is underway at a real address. Sometimes the intent of those false reports is to send specialized police, like SWAT teams, into spaces in which they may use deadly force. Overwhelming police response to false threats can cause distress among those at a targeted location, in this case public schools. The Boulder Valley School District sent out a communication to parents yesterday to make them aware of the string of incidents yesterday, although no BVSD schools were targeted. In a statement released yesterday, the Denver Field Office of the FBI confirmed that the swatting calls involved false reports of an active shooter at schools. This statement said, quote, "The FBI takes swatting very seriously because it puts innocent people at risk and drains law enforcement resources. The identity of those in behind the string of swatting calls is currently undetermined." A separate incident on Monday, Adams City High School was briefly placed on lockdown Monday afternoon after reports that a student had brought a weapon to school. Shortly after issuing the lockdown at around 1 p.m., police took a student into custody. In a communication sent to parents, school principal Chris Garcia urged parents to speak with students about the, quote, "the dangers of bringing a weapon of any kind to school or even threatening to use a weapon," after school activities and school dismissal continued as scheduled. The Colorado Supreme Court will hear oral arguments today in a case that questions the validity of unused oil and gas leases in Boulder County. Steve Miller from KGNU has more.
The case was filed in 2017, with the county arguing that several of oil and gas sites leased to Crestone Peak in eastern Boulder County expired due to a lack of oil and gas production. The Boulder County District Court and then Colorado Court of Appeals have heard the case and ruled against the county, finding that the leases should remain in place even though the oil and gas wells were idle and were not extracting oil or gas. Boulder County's website issued a statement saying that if the leases are found to have expired, the county will have full control over the mineral rights, to the extent possible, under state law. The website also said that most of the county's oil and gas leases are 40 years old or more, with outdated royalty rates and other terms, and the wells associated with those leases have often been shut in for long periods of time. The hearing can be heard this morning at 10 a.m. on the Colorado Supreme Court website. For KGNU, I'm Steve Miller.
At next week's City Council meeting, council members will consider making the west part of Pearl Street permanently car-free. KGNU's James Swenson has more.
At last week's City Council meeting, Boulder members said they were going ahead with a plan to reopen West Pearl Street to cars as soon as this month, a move that would bring the pedestrian-friendly transformation ushered in by the COVID-19 pandemic to at least a temporary end. Since the announcement, Boulder residents have come out in force asking the city to reconsider their decision. They say they liked having the west end of Pearl Street closed off to cars and want to be able to continue the outdoor dining that pandemic protocol once required. At the end of August 2022, City Manager Nuria Rivera Vandermeet lifted the emergency measure that allowed restaurants to use public sidewalks and streets. Nearly all businesses have since cleared out their tables and tents along West Pearl. Only concrete barriers block cars from passing through. City Council will be asking next week to approve adjustments in the city staff's work plan to allow them to continue to explore the topic of closing streets for other purposes, not just for West Pearl, but potentially for other places in the city, explaining, "We look forward to a more robust conversation with the community on those possibilities and planning efforts soon." Aside from being required to reopen to the street due to the temporary nature of the closure, the city cited the impact on businesses as a reason to reopen the street, while a more permanent solution is examined. With an eye toward getting people out of their cars, the Transportation Advisory Board argued in favor of keeping West Pearl closed to vehicular traffic. On the other hand, the Downtown Management Commission argued that more research needs to be done before coming to a long-term conclusion. "Opening West Pearl now does not mean it will never close again," Chair Don Poe said. "It means we're going to be planning and doing this in a wise way." For KGNU, I'm James Swenson.
The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment is expanding its eligibility criteria for monkeypox vaccine. The CDPHE hopes this expansion will offer more protections to people with higher risk exposures to monkeypox. Those who now qualify include individuals who had sexual contact with someone who had monkeypox within 14 days. State epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Hurley says the expansion allows Coloradans to proactively protect themselves and their communities by getting vaccinated before potential exposures rather than only after a known exposure. The City of Boulder Police Oversight Panel is seeking volunteers and hosting recruitment sessions at a Thursday's meeting. The Police Oversight Panel is in charge of investigating complaints against the city police. Those interested can speak with members of the current Police Oversight Panel between 6 to 7 p.m. at Boulder Public Library's main branch. Today in Boulder, there's going to be a high of 88 and a low of 57 with a current temperature of 65 degrees. In Fort Collins, there's going to be a high of 91 and a low of 51 with a current temperature of 53 degrees. In Denver, Colorado, there's going to be a high of 90 and a low of 60 with a current temperature of 63 degrees. For KGNU, I am Luis Licon.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Comic conventions are a subculture of their own, and now there's a new book out documenting its past and present. Matthew Klickstein is the author of See You at San Diego, an oral history of Comic-Con, fandom, and the triumph of geek culture. And he joins me live in the studio this morning ahead of a couple of local events this week. Good morning, Matthew.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And I guess I should say welcome back because you lived in Boulder. You actually were a former volunteer at KGNU.
I was, yeah. I volunteered here. I wrote for some of the local newspapers, and I actually established a program through Imagine when I was working for them, where we worked with persons with disabilities doing their own radio production here. So that was a lot of fun.
Very nice. So if you were to explain Comic-Con culture to somebody completely unfamiliar with it, what would you say?
Well, we decided to focus on Comic-Con because it is the largest pop culture gathering worldwide, according to Guinness Book of World Records. But really, the book goes back an entire century, in some cases a little bit more, Mary Shelley to, you know, science fiction and that kind of thing, to really talk about fandom itself, pop culture nostalgia, and how we went from people like H.G. Wells and H.P. Lovecraft to where we are today, where every movie, every TV show, everything is fantasy, science fiction, comic books, Lord of the Rings, Twilight, whatever it might be. And that's really what the book is chronicling through the lens of the prehistory, history, and expansion of the largest pop culture gathering worldwide, Comic-Con.
And you describe this work, your book, as an oral history. Why?
It is basically a Talking Heads documentary on paper. I spoke to over 50 people, many of the originators of Comic-Con, but a lot of special guests, people like Kevin Smith, Neil Gaiman, Frank Miller, Bruce Campbell, Lloyd Kaufman of Troma, Felicia Day, Scott Aukerman, a number of other people. We got RZA from Wu-Tang to do the afterword, actually. And it's them talking about all of their memories and stories of, again, not just Comic-Con, but pop culture itself, how science fiction really changed things, special effects in the 90s, going all the way back, really, even to the 60s and 70s, a lot of the counterculture stuff that was going on. A lot of people might not know this, but Dr. Timothy Leary was a special guest at Comic-Con in 1975. There's good reason for that. Some of the underground comics things that were going on, connections to rock and roll, V Vietnam, what was going on at Berkeley at the time. So all these things were happening around the same time. And I spoke with people who were there living it, many people well into their 70s and 80s now. And I cut it together very much like a Talking Heads documentary, except it's a book. So it's transcribed that way. There's also over 400 pictures and art from private archives, colleges, museums, and that kind of thing. So it really immerses you in this world. And we're talking Ray Bradbury and Robert Heinlein going all the way back to the early 1900s.
And I guess I should have imagined this before diving into the book, given its subject matter, but the scrapbook style graphic design is really nice. Can you speak about what all thought and planning went into the visual aspect of telling these stories?
I know that someone's actually gotten a copy of the book because I get a text message or an email from them saying, oh my gosh, Matt, I didn't realize, first of all, how big it is. It's huge. It's like a phone book. And second
of all, it's more than 450 pages.
Yes, it's really large. Also, again, with all the photos and art. But the design is something that a lot of people bring up. We've actually gotten some reviews of the design itself. Our designer, Jonathan Barley, B-A-R-L-I, is great. And he and I really wanted to work it out so that it was this DIY feel, almost kind of a punk rock kind of a sensibility, because the zine scene was very important to science fiction in the early 1900s. It's where people like H.P. Lovecraft really got their start. And there is a lot about, again, counterculture and the underground magazines, underground comics, and even things like punk rock and such well into the 70s and 80s in the book and how that connected to a lot of this. So it looks like there's little paper clips in there and scotch tape. And we worked very, very hard on the design of the book to give it that feel that you're really there and experiencing it. And as you said, going through a scrapbook almost of this material.
That dovetails perfectly into what I wanted to ask you about. You touch on this genre within this subculture that, you know, many people don't necessarily associate with comic books, and that's the zine culture, right? And it's this niche of self-published counterculture fanzines for younger people, like our interns and volunteers here, who grew up after social media had monopolized the avenues of self-published expression and distribution channels. Explain what zines were and what role they played in truly independent media.
Again, they really started in the science fiction world in the early 1900s. It was the only way that people could connect with each other who were fans of science fiction, who were really into radio, who were into these kinds of short stories and that kind of thing. And they would actually put their addresses in there. They'd put their phone numbers so they could connect with each other, because as you said, there wasn't social media yet. And there were people, again, like H.P. Lovecraft, who really started in that world. Eventually, the comic scene kind of took that over as well and started doing a lot of that in the 60s and 70s with mimeographs and people like Gilbert Shelton and Frank Stack doing underground comics, and of course people like Robert Crumb and others who started coming in. And it was a way for them to circumvent the larger publishers when they wanted to do things that were more about feminism, about the environment, about drugs, sex, rock and roll. And that's a lot of what my book is about as well. A lot of people might not realize this, but these people were not the typical nerds or geeks that you think they were. They were really into some of these really interesting things that were going on in the counterculture in the 60s and 70s. And so they were able to talk to each other through these zines. And then, of course, that went well into the punk rock scene and hip hop scene of the 90s as well.
This is so much to talk about. We are running out of time, but you will be on Metro this afternoon. So anybody who wants to hear a bit more about this topic and digging into the details, you can tune in at 3 p.m. today here on KGNU. Matthew Klickstein, tell us about the events that you're going to be at this week in this area.
Today, I'll be at the Tattered Cover at Aspen Grove at 6 o'clock. You can come by there. And I'll also be at Mile High Comics tomorrow, Wednesday, from 2 to 6 p.m. And you can meet me up there. You can check out the book. You can order it anywhere online or at your local bookstores or comic book shops. There's also an audiobook version that's coming out, I think, tomorrow. And there's a lot more coming out with it as well, including a podcast that we did with SiriusXM and Stitcher about a year ago called Comic-Con Begins, available on all platforms for free as well. So there's plenty of material out there. And of course, you can find out about all of this and more at my website, www.matthewklickstein.com. That's Matthew with one T, KLICKSTEIN.com.
Matthew Klickstein is the author of See You at San Diego, an oral history of Comic-Con fandom and the triumph of geek culture. Thanks for dropping by the studio today.
Thank you.
Time now for the latest edition of This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
A car that captures carbon as it drives. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Instead of going public, you could say we're going purpose.
That's what Yvon Chouinard announced on the Patagonia website, a company he started 50 years ago. He and his family donated all their stock, about $3 billion worth, to fight the climate crisis and protect undeveloped land.
Patagonia will maintain its business, selling shirts, jackets, and ski wear with some fabric made out of recycled plastic bottles, but it will be owned and directed by two organizations. Annual profits of about $100 million a year will be distributed to environmental causes.
Some have described Chouinard as an eccentric. He used to spend more than 200 nights a year sleeping outdoors, and he lived in his car as a pioneering rock climber in Yosemite Valley during the 1960s, eating cat food out of damaged cans he bought for a nickel each. At 83, he still drives a beat-up Subaru with a surfboard on top.
5 years ago, when he was listed in Forbes magazine as one of the world's richest people, Chouinard felt it was a sign that he had failed his mission to make the world a better and fairer place. He then made it his mission to give his company away.
It's not clear who or what will be the recipient of Patagonia's profits to fight climate change. In the past, the company has donated about 1% of earnings mainly to grassroots organizations.
Seafood is one of the most traded commodities in the world, and it's susceptible to fraud.
To address the problem, a team of researchers from Australia have figured out a way, akin to using fingerprints, to trace chemicals in fish bones and shells of many marine species to stop illegal and unsustainable fishing.
The chemicals can show where the fish have been living and their origins. Some seafood suppliers deceive businesses and consumers about where fish are caught, and some products are substituted with lower quality or from places that have fewer regulations about sustainability.
The researchers say that poor quality seafood can contain pathogens and fewer nutrients.
The nutritional content of seafood and its carbon footprint was the subject of other new research. Herring, mackerel, anchovies, and other fish living near the ocean's surface have more nutrients than beef, pork, or chicken, and they generate fewer greenhouse gas emissions than livestock.
About one-third of global greenhouse gases come from food production, and almost half of those are from livestock farming. The researchers say that while plant-based diets are a good alternative to eating meat, blue diets, those based on seafood, are often overlooked.
A prototype car developed in the Netherlands sucks. Carbon dioxide, that is. The Zero Emission Mobility Vehicle, named ZEM, was built by students in TU Ecomotive at Eindhoven University of Technology, and it captures CO2 as it drives.
The battery-powered EV uses direct air capture technology that filters and stores carbon dioxide. The team estimates that 10 cars driving around 20,000 miles a year would suck up over 40 pounds of CO2 annually, translating to the amount sequestered by one tree, a number that would really add up if their concept caught on with automakers.
The sporty two-seater is intended to be zero emission, not only by capturing carbon, but also by making its manufacturing process as low emission as possible. Although electric vehicles don't emit CO2, battery production is polluting, and it can take driving tens of thousands of miles before EVs achieve what's called carbon parity with their gas-powered counterparts.
To make ZEM truly sustainable, its components are 3D printed using recycled plastic, which can be shredded and reused at the end of its life.
ZEM is currently on tour around the U.S., where the team hopes to inspire other students and perhaps capture the attention of automakers with their direct capture coupe.
And finally, basking sharks are so named for their inclination to bask in warm waters near the ocean's surface to filter feed off plankton. The creatures grow close to 40 feet long and can be solitary and cover long distances. So when it comes to romance, how does a basking shark find love?
According to a new study, they turn to speed dating. scientists in Ireland documented rarely observed circling behaviors where basking sharks slowly swam in levels of a three-tiered dance.
The groups had equal numbers of males and females who were definitely not feeding. Some of the females changed their body color to be paler than males, something often seen during courtship in other shark species to signal a willingness to mate.
As the sharks gracefully passed each other, sizing each other up as the one, they gently touched each other's fins and bodies, and within minutes, mated.
Basking sharks were hunted throughout much of the 20th century for their liver oil to be used in lamps, lubricants, and cosmetics, and currently they're categorized as endangered in the Northeast Atlantic and North Pacific Oceans.
The researchers hope their findings can help identify and protect other courtship sites around the world to ensure this gentle giant's love dance can continue.
That's it for This Week in Water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
An annual hot air balloon bonanza brought dozens of colorful vessels to Snowmass Village this past weekend. For Rocky Mountain Community Radio, Kaya Williams of Aspen Public Radio has more from the Snowmass Balloon Festival, which began Friday and wrapped up Sunday.
In the unpredictable world of hot air ballooning, you have to stay sharp to stay afloat. Pilot Skip Howes from Colorado Springs says that's part of the allure. He was in Snowmass Village on Friday morning with his balloon, called Wildfire, for the annual balloon festival based in Town Park.
It's quiet, it's relaxing but challenging at the same time when you fly. You have to be on your game and all of that. But it's a different kind of stress or a different kind of adrenaline rush, maybe? I don't know. It's just a ball. Just a ball.
Then again, you might need to be a little foolish to get into a wicker basket to begin with. Some cheery self-deprecation may well be a prerequisite for hot air balloonists. Those with decades of experience like to joke about how little they knew when they started. Mark Whiting, a pilot based in Denver, was hovering over the softball field on Friday morning in a circus-themed balloon called Big Top. He got hooked on hot air in the late 1970s. He was working for RE/MAX, the international real estate company known for its hot air balloon logo, when the first real-life RE/MAX balloon arrived.
And they came in and they were proudly going, "The balloon's here, the balloon's here." And I went, "Far out, what's a balloon?"
He decided to go out and help with the crew in an off-white three-piece suit and expensive shoes.
And we're out in a little field that's muddier than all mud. And I've got mud up to here.
He gestures to his upper thigh.
And I've got a splash all over my vest. I fortunately took my jacket off. And the pilot looked at me when we were all said and done, and he said, "You know, you're just stupid enough to be a pilot." So, sure enough, here I am.
Doug Lenberg was hanging out with Howes and Whiting and the rest of the Chatty Big Top crew on Friday morning. He says tequila got him into the game back in 1986.
I was partying with a good friend of mine, and I got a little bit too much tequila in me, and he said, "You want to help me put up a flying pink pig?" And I said, "What? Okay, I'll do it."
So he helped put up a balloon shaped like a piggy bank for the United New Mexico Bank. He moved from special shapes to regular balloons after that, and piloted for years before turning to event organizing and serving as a balloonmeister at festivals. Long after the tequila wore off, the allure of hot air ballooning stayed fresh. Lenberg has stayed in the field now for more than three decades, through a mid-flight heart attack in 2014, and through the recent loss of his wife, Sylvia. He stays on the ground these days, but he hasn't strayed from the people he says probably make up the friendliest community in the world.
We've never met a stranger, so you come out and you come around the basket, talk to the pilots, talk to the crews, and you will be welcomed. We don't have strangers in our community, and we take care of each other. And that's a huge thing. They've all been for me after my wife recently passed suddenly. The entire community has been there for me all over the country.
Whiting says you could go anywhere on earth and find friendship with the hot air balloon community.
I think it's because of the magic bringing the smiles out of the kids. And there's kids in all of us. I don't care how old you are. There's a kid in there somewhere.
But maybe some champagne helps too. It's a hot air balloon custom to carry two bottles of bubbly on board, one for the pilot and crew, and one for the landowner wherever the vessel sets down. Whiting says it's a winning combination with the fuel used to keep the balloon in the air.
Breakfast of champions, champagne and propane.
From the Edlis-Neeson Arts and Culture Desk, I'm Kaya Williams.
We now check in with KGNU's comment line and the listeners who share their thoughts about what they hear on KGNU.
Good morning. Just wanted to make the comment that it sure was great to hear the Reef Man back on KGNU airwaves yesterday afternoon. Thanks, Sharif. Really appreciate it.
If you'd like to make a comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave a message at our listener comment line at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25. That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to Luis Licon, James Swenson, Steve Miller, Alexis Kenyon, Rosanna Longo-Better, Kaya Williams, Jamie Sudler, and Franny Halperin for their contributions to today's program. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Stay tuned for How on Earth. That's coming up after the news headlines from the BBC.